Support for the full story comes from the Heart and Vascular Center at Bridgeport Hospital, where advanced cardiovascular treatments are met with compassion and a uniquely personalized approach to care. Learn more at bridgeporthospital.org/heart.
This is the full story. I'm Tom Kuser. Well, Connecticut has a new state budget, and it's pretty big. This week, lawmakers approved a $24.2 billion state funding package. Legislative leaders say it was easier to reach a deal this year because the state was, dare I say, rich with funds due to a $4 billion budget surplus and federal pandemic relief money. So what will the budget offer Connecticut residents? WSHU's senior political reporter Ebong Udama is here to talk us through the deal, and he is with us in the studio. Ebong, hello.
Hi, Tom.
Good to see you. So as I mentioned, this year's budget negotiations were somewhat different from previous years because of the wealth of money that's available right now. How much of a role did the money play in the talks?
A very big role. A very calming role. Made them very happy as they were negotiating the budget.
On both sides of the aisle?
On both sides. So much so that the Republicans complained that they would have wanted even more money to be devoted to tax cuts. They voted against the bill because in the House, which is the first chamber that dealt with the budget. Mm-hmm. And they said $600 million in tax cuts, which is historic as far as Connecticut is concerned, is not enough. They had wanted $1.2 billion in tax cuts.
Oh, double. So
and
they
had
double
wanted
the
permanent tax cuts. They say the Democrats went for limited tax cuts that would be phased out. They had wanted permanent across-the-board tax cuts. They wanted even the...
What type of tax relief can people expect to see? What did come through as far as tax cuts?
What came through was directed mainly at families. For instance, in a few months, if you have a child and you're middle class or lower, you will see a $250 per child tax credit. And if you live in certain communities, high car tax communities, you'll see a reduction in your car tax. You will also see the property tax credit has been increased from $200 to $300. So when the tax bills come on the 1st of July, it'll be reflected. So people will actually see a lot of this before November's election. And the gasoline tax holiday has been extended until December 1st. And the free bus service has also been extended until December 1st.
The property tax credit you mentioned, that's applied to homeowners, essentially?
Any property. So it's a standard deduction. It goes up from $200 to $300. That's across the board. And also the pensions and retirement income will no longer see a state tax. So that the state tax has been eliminated from that.
The state income tax?
The state income tax on retirement income is gone.
All the taxes that you just mentioned, you did say the gasoline tax is extended to the 1st of December, and then it's reinstated. What about the other tax credits? Child tax credit, the retirement income tax suspension, are those permanent? Are those temporary?
The child tax credit is for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And then it will be up to another legislature to decide whether they want to continue it or that would be it. It would sunset.
Were those some of the issues that were in contention as far as the Republicans were concerned? They wanted those to be permanent as opposed to temporary as proposed by the Democrats?
Actually, the Republicans were looking for sales tax cuts.
Ah.
They were looking for across-the-board tax cuts, and they were looking for more help for the unemployment insurance to pay down the unemployment insurance for business. And
that's a debt because of what the federal government loaned
yes.
the state, essentially.
So the federal government loaned the state. We're still owing about more than $400 million, which would have to be paid back through a tax on business. And the Republicans wanted that eliminated. They wanted some of the money used for that, and Governor Lamont said no. And basically, the argument that Governor Lamont and the Democrats made is that they want to still have some money in reserve, because the reason why we're in the shape we're in now is the 2017 budget deal, which put caps on how much spending could be done, and that helped build the rainy day fund. And there was also a volatility cap where we get more income tax returns from capital gains, and that fluctuates. And when we get excess, it goes into the reserve. So that made it possible for us, and the stock market has been doing very well in the past years. So that has helped our revenue.
And nothing happened with the sales tax. That remains as is.
Yes, it remains as is. So what we have are these taxes generated. Basically, the tax cuts targeted at the low to middle income families.
Juvenile crime was another key issue in this session. There was bipartisan support for the juvenile crime bill, but there were adjustments made to the bill over a GPS provision, I believe. What was that concern, and what was the resolution to it?
Well, the concern was that if you have any blanket rule that affects everybody, is not the best way to make legislation. And there was concern from Representative Robin Porter, who took the lead on this. She's from New Haven, and she represents a community that was adversely affected by the past crime bills that we've had.
Mm-hmm.
So there was concern from her that we were going too far with this. And so the compromise was made that, okay, we'll have more GPS monitoring, but that would be supervised by the judiciary. So there'd be a judge making decisions on individual cases.
Oh, case by case.
So it would be a case by case application of it. And it wouldn't just be, you know, across the board.
And GPS monitoring means, in other words, keeping track
of the juveniles once they are in the system. And it's the compromise was not enough for Robin Porter, so she actually voted against the bill. And there were a few Republicans who voted against it because they felt it didn't go far enough. But generally, it was a bipartisan legislation. And
Which
passed, mm-hmm. yes.
Also, a bill that would expand access to absentee ballots. How would that work?
Well, it's not no excuse. It's basically, you know, Connecticut has some of the strictest absentee ballot rules. And what happened during COVID is that legislation was passed to basically to allow anyone who wanted an absentee ballot to have one. So now it's not for a specific illness, but you can say it's for sickness, which would cover concerns about COVID or any other kind of sickness and would qualify you to get an absentee ballot. And the statistics do show that a lot more people showed up and took part in the election because they had easier access to absentee ballots in the last election. So pretty much it would be extending that to November's election.
WSHU's senior political reporter Ebong Udama is with us here in the studio today. We're talking about some of the significant actions that have been taken in the most recent General Assembly session in Connecticut. The Clean Air Bill Another measure that was up for discussion and voted would accelerate the adoption of electric vehicles. Tell us more about that.
Well, by 2030, all school buses would have to be electric, and all transit buses would have to be electric. And there's actually some federal money that we can tap into to help make this happen. And also, it would extend rebates to e-bikes as well as electric vehicles. And you'd be able to have rebates for used electric vehicles, which would now open up the market to more lower-income people being able to afford it. And also, it has money in it for more charging stations across the state. So it will move. Environmental issues have really been dealt with in this year that Governor Lamont had problems getting through the last time because of the highway toll bill that was included in that. So this time the highway tolls were stripped and a lot of the environmental legislation was able to be passed.
Mental health was another major issue as we emerge from the pandemic, and there was a key decision to provide more resources for children's mental health. How does this legislation do that?
More money for school-based health care for children, easier access so that the use of the emergency room would be reduced. And it also has money for providers, and it would compel insurance companies to cover a lot more of what they don't cover now. So about $200 million was devoted to that. So, we've been talking about mental health since Sandy Hook. Mm. But the problem we've had all along has been not enough money has been devoted to it. We've talked about it. Legislation has been passed. But not much money has been put into it. This is a large chunk of money. So basically, lawmakers for the first time are actually putting their money where their mouth is.
What moved them to do that this time around? The fact that there was money to burn, so to speak, money to spend?
That helped.
Or were there other reasons with the pandemic? What spurred that?
And the fact that the pandemic affected people across the board. And we can see the effects, you know. Lawmakers had personal experience. And
that made a difference.
And that I think, made the big difference.
There were also limits put on solitary confinement in state prisons, right?
Yes. That's a bill that passed last year but was vetoed by Governor Ned Lamont. And he was the corrections officers were concerned that this would stymie their ability to control large populations of incarcerated people, because the ratio of correction officers to inmates is pretty high. And so a compromise was struck where, you know, it's not as there is still solitary confinement allowed, but it's been reduced. And this time the governor is signing the bill.
So the occasions or the situations where it can be used
have been limited.
Fewer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, finally, this week, the big national story was the leaked Supreme Court draft decision that appears to completely repeal the landmark Roe versus Wade ruling back in 1973. In this budget, lawmakers did strengthen Connecticut's law that guarantees a woman's right to an abortion. How did it do that?
We have already codified Roe v. Wade in Connecticut since the 90s. And what this does, it creates a safe harbor so that a woman can cross the border into Connecticut and have an abortion, and states that do not permit abortion cannot reach into Connecticut to hold Connecticut officials liable, and Connecticut officials have been prohibited from enabling outside states to take action in Connecticut, so creating a safe harbor for women's abortion rights in Connecticut.
Does it do the same for people who aren't necessarily officials, but maybe connected yes. with procedures?
Yes, and it also expands. You don't have to be a physician. You can be a physician assistant. A lot more people who are involved in the healthcare of women have the authority now, have the legal ability to be involved in abortions than before.
Before I let you go, can we talk about elections? This year's legislative session was short because it is an election year. Voters are looking at choosing several key statewide seats. There's governor, state controller, secretary of the state, treasurer as well. Could you give us some insights on how these races are shaping up?
We're going to see a lot of new faces, not just on the constitutional level, but we have more than 33 lawmakers who are not coming back. So we're going to see a lot of new faces. And that's going to make for some interesting contests going forward, because all those constitutional seats are held by Democrats, so it's an opportunity for Republicans. But also among the Democrats, it's going to be pretty contentious. There are a number of people running for each of these seats, and not everyone is going to be get the party nod in the conventions this week. So we're going to see a very lively primary season and primary election in August, and then leading into the general election in November. So I would think that we're going to have a pretty high turnout in November's election.
For the midterm
elections in Connecticut because of that.
Given the number of incumbents who aren't running, state Senate, state House, any chance that the majority will change hands from Democrat to Republican?
There's always a chance. However, there are so many factors involved. And national politics, talking about the abortion decision, might play a bigger role than it normally would in this year's election. So that's something to watch out for.
Ebong Udama is WSHU's senior political reporter. Ebong, thanks for your time today and insights. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
A rise in the number of young people stealing cars last year led some lawmakers and community leaders in Connecticut to call for a harsher response to juvenile crime. This year, a packet of proposals was designed to change Connecticut's juvenile crime laws. What's in those proposals? Are they necessary? And does the passage of the state budget by the General Assembly have any effect on them? We've asked the executive director of the Connecticut Justice Alliance, Christina Quaranta, to help us answer those questions. And she joins us via Zoom. Ms. Quaranta, welcome back to The Full Story.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Certainly. First of all, what's the mission of the Connecticut Justice Alliance?
The mission of the Connecticut Justice Alliance is to end the criminalization of youth.
And a quick question about the name of your organization. I believe you dropped juvenile from the earlier name. Why was that?
We dropped the juvenile from our name to focus on the justice. A lot of times the connotations that come with the word juvenile are bad. If you see news headlines, the way people talk about young folks, they'll use the word juvenile, and it's always something negative that's happened or a negative policy they're trying to push. So we are encouraging people to use the word youth, young person, et cetera, instead of juvenile.
So the word's sort of become a pejorative then.
It has.
Last year, there was a rise nationally in the theft of cars by young people. The Justice Alliance actually wrote an op-ed addressing that issue. Was this rising crime trend misunderstood?
I think the rising crime trend was absolutely misunderstood. And I think for a lot of folks, they were not paying attention to the actual data that we had in front of us. We saw through many presentations, credit goes out to Ken Barone from IMRP out of UConn now, that car thefts were not necessarily in a heavy uptick, but where they were happening geographically in the state was shifting. So instead of being in the big urban centers, the big cities, shifting to the more urban areas, up the 95 and 91 corridor, where folks were saying this hadn't happened here before and now it is and we're upset, which rightfully so. But if we're going to talk about an issue, I think we need to use factual statements instead of using anecdotes or assumptions. I also think looking at a spot in Connecticut such as New Canaan, who had something like an increase of, let's say, 5 car thefts in a year from 2019 to 2020, that looked like a large percentage. So talking to folks, it's like, you know, there was a huge jump in car thefts in New Canaan, but really it was only 5, you know, because they went from maybe like 10 to 15. So I think it's just paying better attention to the data that we have and really paying attention to the root cause of why it might be happening.
And the data then would suggest that there being a shift, the numbers not being incredibly higher when the thefts were occurring in the cities, the call for some sort of reform was not happening.
That's correct. So that's a big concern of ours, because we see, like many issues nationally and in Connecticut, that it's a racial justice issue, because like you stated, when car thefts and car break-ins were happening in bigger cities, Bridgeport, Waterbury, Hartford, New Haven, folks were not talking about passing sweeping youth justice reform and erasing and rolling back all the progress that we've made. There was no talk about that. And when car thefts and break-ins were happening in predominantly white neighborhoods and areas, that became the ask from lawmakers, is we need to roll back all of the reforms that we've made. Juveniles, as they would say, you know, are causing all of this. And even when we look at the data and we're able to see who is breaking into cars, who's stealing cars, a small percent were young people and the larger percent were adults. So that also begs the question of why are legislators so intent on pushing change? And session just ended yesterday and a bill passed to push negative change for young people, when the majority of cars that are stolen and broken into Connecticut is not done by young people.
You testified before the State Judiciary Committee about the bills that were proposed this year, and there were 4 that you were against. Could you tell us about those?
Sure. Early in March, I did testify in front of the Judiciary Committee. That was both a gun day and a youth justice day. So there are a lot of bills on the table that would impact young people negatively. Now, what the contents of those bills look like, making it easier and possible to transfer 13 and 14-year-old children to the adult criminal legal system, making it easier to send a young person to detention for reasons that we do not right now, because we know that it doesn't actually improve public safety, and making it easier to surveil young people are using GPS or electronic monitoring, which is just another form of incarceration that is e-carceration. Most of the bills that were put forth in front of the Judiciary Committee this year were not aimed at addressing the roots at all for young people, families, or communities. There was one bill I can think of, the Juvenile Justice Policy and Oversight Committee bill, that did not make it out of the Judiciary Committee for different behind the scenes politics reasons, that actually would help young people to move forward in Connecticut, increase public safety. And that did not even make it out. So that is discouraging.
Was that one of the 2 bills? I understand there were 2 bills that the Alliance did support. Was that one of the 2 that you found to be beneficial?
It was one of the 2 bills, yes. Mm.
The other one?
The other one was making it against the law for cops to use deceptive interrogation tactics on young people, which passed the House, but did not come up for a vote in the Senate as of midnight last night.
So do you think lawmakers heard your concerns?
You know, it's such a struggle, because I think certain lawmakers heard concerns, and it was an interesting year, because usually looking at the yes votes for House Bill 5417 yesterday, you saw people that have been youth justice champions vote yes to pass that bill, which would negatively impact young people and not improve public safety. That just brings the question of, you know, why did that happen? What other politics are going on in that building? What other horse trading is happening? Because that's not something that would usually happen. That was kind of a surprise. It's not supposed to happen. We do struggle with having some legislators hear the points of, here are the facts, of here are all the numbers, I'm looking at them now, of car thefts in Connecticut. Here's how the trend has gone. And here's what we know is best practice to reduce car thefts in Connecticut. And then it has worked nationally in other places like Baltimore and Chicago. So we should be doing that here. We should not be further criminalizing young people and making it easier to lock them up when we know they're going to come right back home and possibly do the same thing again because we did not do anything to address the root cause. People have a hard time hearing that, understanding that, and putting it into practice because lots of legislators and citizens, other folks, want to see something happen right now that's punishment that makes them feel better about taking care of the issue, right? So it has been difficult to get the point heard. Folks are not as in tune to data and the reality. So that was a huge struggle this session and will continue to be.
Is a large part of it just a lack of understanding? Do the proposals need to be more clear, more, and I don't mean this negatively, more simple so that they come across more clearly to legislators?
Perhaps. I'm not sure. We are going to have to go back to the drawing board for how we talk to the public and to legislators about the issue of youth crime and the issue of car thefts and how we can best improve public safety. We're just going to have to do a whole nother sort of tour of the state and have more conversations with people about what is public safety? What does that mean to you? How can we assure that you will be safe without further incarcerating people? Because we know incarceration doesn't actually make communities safer in the long term. And that's what everybody wants. That's what I want. We're not saying not to have people hold themselves accountable. And we're not saying that people, even young people, should not be able to hold themselves accountable for something that happened. But there's different ways to do it. I think folks need some more time to absorb that punishment does not equal change to behavior, and that restorative justice and actually addressing folks' root problems. So, you know, Senator Bradley talked about it yesterday on the floor of the Senate, saying, hey, we need to address root causes of education, inequity in food, inequity in housing and jobs. And he's got it right. That's what we have to do. And I know I mentioned it before, but it's very difficult to get people to see we have to address all of these other things before we're going to see a change in crime. And it's easier for people to say, let me just pass this law because this should do it. But that's not going to be the case.
Christina Quaranta is the executive director of the Connecticut Justice Alliance. Thank you so much for your time today and your insights on a very important issue. We appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Certainly. As we just heard, last year, Governor Ned Lamont vetoed a bill that would have limited the use of solitary confinement in state prisons. This year, he says he'll sign it. So what's changed? We're asking Raisha Bivens. She's a justice advocate and digital organizer at Stop Solitary CT, and she joins us via Zoom. Welcome back to The Full Story.
Hi. Thank you, Tom.
Certainly.
Yeah.
First, if you could remind us about the work of Stop Solitary Confinement.
Yeah, absolutely. So Stop Solitary CT is a legislative steering committee that has been in existence in Connecticut for over 5 years. And the mission of our organization is to really end solitary confinement in Connecticut and replace it with safe, humane, and effective alternatives. As we know, solitary confinement is really largely ineffective at reducing violence and keeping people incarcerated as well as those that work in prison safe.
The term seems self-explanatory, but really maybe we should define solitary confinement as it's used in Connecticut currently.
Yeah, so that's an interesting question because Department of Corrections will say that they don't have solitary confinement in Connecticut. And that's actually inaccurate according to the Mandela rules and international law. Solitary confinement is, you know, it's more described as a way of being. And if we want to get into technicalities around numbers, you know, solitary confinement is really defined as keeping people in their cells in a small confined space for as much as 21 hours out the day. Right. So our philosophy has been more about eliminating prolonged isolation because the Department of Corrections, again, will deny that they have solitary confinement. But there's people in general population in Connecticut, meaning they haven't had any disciplinary issues. They're just in their cells for 21 hours out the day or more, because that's how Department of Corrections manages the population So we would even define that as solitary confinement because it's prolonged isolation, and we know that that has debilitating impacts on people. So that's been our approach to legislation. Yeah.
So in terms of the number of days someone is in that situation, from your perspective, there really is no threshold. If it's one day, 21 hours in the cell, you've begun solitary confinement.
Correct, correct. And, you know, and then there's two parts of what I was saying that I want to break down a little bit, mm-hmm. if you don't mind.
Sure.
So I got involved in solitary, in Stop Solitary CT when my brother Joshua was incarcerated. And he was held in his cell 21 hours out the day as someone with schizophrenia for the duration of his incarceration at Garner Correctional Facility, right? So there was nothing that wavered about that experience.
And how long was that?
That was for 3 years.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Right. And there's many people that are in general population across the state of Connecticut in prisons like Cheshire, where they're also held even in, you know, 23 hours in their cell in general population. Right. So that's one piece of what our legislation has been approaching, is that people in general population deserve to have more time out of cell because extreme isolation is debilitating. The other piece of it is there are people in Connecticut that are put into what Department of Corrections will call administrative segregation. You know, that's typically if someone has an issue where there's some, you know, violation of some of the rules inside of the prison, which are very subjective, to be honest. And the standards around that, putting someone in a separate place, which DOC calls segregation, or there's other terms that they go by, and according to international law, which we did use as a standard for this new legislation, keeping someone in those conditions for 15 days or longer is defined as torture. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think, you know, I'm a licensed clinical social worker. There are many people on our committee that have that experience as well. I think it's very difficult to get into debates about, you know, oh, is one day okay? Is 15 days okay? But to really get this bill passed, we decided to stay into alignment with the Nelson Mandela rules because that's recognized across the United States and internationally as a standard. So what the PROTECT Act does is it limits, you know, no one can be in solitary confinement for longer than 15 days, you know, in a 60-day period.
From what you've learned, what effect does solitary confinement have on an individual, on their physical and mental health? Every individual is different, of course, but are there some common problems that that occur after someone's in or when someone's in solitary confinement?
Yeah, absolutely. People are known to, and this is very well researched, and people are known to develop psychiatric symptoms in as little as a 1 week period. So that, you know, people lose touch with reality. You know, they, you know, can have experienced psychosis and breaks with reality, increases in depression. You know, all of that are some of the really common, you know, impacts of being in solitary confinement and really prolonged isolation.
Is it just adults that are subject to solitary confinement as Stop Solitary CT defines it, or are people younger than 18 also subject to it?
Yeah, people younger than 18 are subject to solitary confinement. You know, what's interesting is that has been illegal for some years. There was other legislation passed, I believe, at least 4 years ago, where the use of solitary confinement on young people 18 and younger was prohibited by law. But we know for a fact that that's actually still been happening. So this version of our legislation reinforces that's, you know, illegal. But that legislation was passed in Connecticut years ago to determine that, you know, because as I'm sure you know, juveniles, you know, people under the age of 18, their brains, you know, haven't even fully developed. So, you know, the lasting impact of that, I think, is even more traumatizing. But it's also known to have a lasting impact for adults. There are people who experience solitary confinement who I know many people formerly incarcerated where they still have difficulty being with large groups of people. There's still, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder. So, yeah.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about this year's legislation in a bit more detail. But first, let's look at last year's, the 2021 PROTECT Act, which I believe was passed by both chambers of the Connecticut General Assembly, but not signed by Governor Lamont. What was in that act?
Yeah, so the PROTECT Act last year in 2021, the difference was is that we said through that legislation that people could not be held in solitary confinement for longer than 72 hours. So that legislation was some of the most like anti-solitary, like most revolutionary anti-solitary legislation in the nation. In addition, we were mandating in that legislation that people had to have a minimum of 7 hours of out-of-cell time per day. So again, not something that necessarily exists in other states that have passed legislation, but we were really, our mission and our philosophy with that bill was to eliminate the culture of isolation. Because really there's 95% of people who are incarcerated will return to the community. And if we aren't setting them up, you know, to learn how to engage with people from a pro-social standpoint, you know, we're really like that puts people more at risk for recidivism and just for lasting psychological harm when they return to the community. So those were the main differences. We also did not have a, in this version of the bill, the 22-2 version, we have a corrections advisory council. And last year's version, we only had the ombudsman. You know, which is, you know, a team of people that incarcerated people can express their grievances to when they are not having their issues addressed through the DOC system. It's a third party that is intended to be neutral so that there's really accountability and other protections for people incarcerated. So those were the, you know, the main other components of the 2021 version of the PROTECT Act.
And the governor did issue an executive order last year, even though he didn't sign that bill. What was the difference between the order that clearly he was in favor of and the bill which he was not?
Yeah, so the executive order, it pretty much mandated the Mandela rules that I was speaking to earlier, that no one could be held in solitary confinement for longer than 15 consecutive days. So, you know, that's what his executive order did. It also mandated that, you know, people have 4 hours of out-of-cell time a day. So those were the main differences, a lot less, you know, in that executive order. So
yeah. So the bill this year is something that that you're supporting, Stop Solitary CT is supporting. Are you happy with how it wound up?
Yeah, we're extremely happy. Our lead organizer, Barbara Fair, who's been doing advocacy work for many, many years, she really took the lead and she met with DOC every week to negotiate what's in the current PROTECT Act. And that was very important because we needed to develop a veto-proof strategy. And we knew that absent of really sitting down and negotiating with Department of Corrections, that our bill could possibly pass again and be vetoed. And so we are very happy with it. And the reason we are is because this is a stepping stone. There are a lot of other changes that we want to see happen in the system, but the community, the Corrections Advisory Council is really a long-term structure that will allow us to ongoingly introduce the things that need to be changed and transformed in the system. And so through that mechanism, we can see out of cell time increasing beyond the 5 days that is in the current PROTECT Act. And we can just, you know, see an ongoing structure for those changes.
You've partially answered my last question, which is, given that the bill has passed, what's next for Stop Solitary CT?
Yeah, I think our focus is on how we can influence the people that are selected to be on the community, the Corrections Advisory Council. You know, I think we're going to have to reimagine, you know, spend some time kind of reimagining what our work looks like over the next year after the passage of the legislation. But I would imagine that our focus would be on the implementation, right? Because there's a lots of cases where legislation gets passed. And if you're not still around to hold those people accountable, there's a lot of pushback when it comes to implementation. So I can imagine that our focus would be largely you know, on implementation over the next year. But those are discussions we're going to, you know, have as a group to continue to formulate what that looks like. So, yeah. And the last thing I want to say about this version of the PROTECT Act. So eventually incarcerated people will have 5 hours out of cell time, you know, per day. And we've heard, you know, we work in partnership with the Yale Lowstein Clinic, and they go inside, they have clients who are incarcerated inside. And really, even though ultimately we would love for the out of cell time to be 7 hours or 8 hours, we know that 5 hours to them represents a significant change, you know, for those who are not used to that. So I think that's the most important thing, is that even though we want more and we are going to continue to work for more through the mechanisms in the PROTECT Act, this will mean a lot, you know, to them. It's a lot different than what the status quo has been. So I just wanted to add that.
Is that a difficult transition for someone who's been accustomed, if that's the right word, to being in their cells up to 21 hours a day, to now suddenly have 5 hours or potentially down the road even more hours? Is that a difficult transition for an individual to work with?
I think it could be, and that's part of the reasons why we were okay with 5 hours to start, because we also want to make sure Department of Corrections is prepared and has a plan around programming, and is not just, you know, having people out of their cells with nothing to do, which can be a recipe really in any environment for disaster. If people aren't engaged, if, you know, there aren't programs, you know, that could be a concern to just kind of flood the system with this change. So that's why we were okay with the 5 hours initially, so that we can give Department of Corrections time to implement activities that really make a difference for people incarcerated and prepare the ones that are returning to the community for that. So
we look forward to talking with you again about how things are progressing.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Raisha Bivens is a justice advocate and digital organizer at Stop Solitary CT. Thanks so much for your time today and your insights. We appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you.
Have a great day.
You too. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
During the pandemic, there was a sharp rise in children and teens seeking mental health support for anxiety and depression at emergency rooms. The growing demand prompted Connecticut state lawmakers to pass a package of bills that provides tens of millions of dollars to address the pandemic's toll on youth. Let's get a closer look at what's in those bills. Jeffrey Vanderplug will help us do that. He's the president and chief executive officer of the Child Health and Development Institute of Connecticut. He has a PhD in clinical psychology from Bowling Green State and has completed predoctoral and postdoctoral training at the Yale University School of Medicine. Welcome to The Full Story.
Thank you for having me.
Certainly. First off, if you could tell us, what is the Child Health and Development Institute of Connecticut, and what kind of work do you do?
Yeah, Child Health Development, you'll hear me refer to it as CHDI. Mm-hmm. We are what we like to call an intermediary organization. And what I mean by that is we don't provide direct mental health services to children and families ourselves. But what we do is that we work with those who provide services to support the work that they do to ensure that it's more effective and that we're getting the kinds of outcomes that we all want to see for our children and families. We also work at the system and policy level. So we work with all the state agencies that fund and oversee direct mental health services for kids and families. And in many ways, we act as a bridge between those groups. What we find often is that state agencies or legislators may have funding or great ideas about how to better support children and families and their mental health needs. And we certainly have a great network of providers out there who want to meet those needs. But we provide a link between those two. Sometimes there is disconnect between the funding and the ability to implement what that funding is directed towards. And we try to bridge that gap. We provide a lot of training and technical assistance. We do a lot of data reporting and quality improvement activities with our provider network. And then we also work with those state systems and policymakers to ensure that we're putting policies in place that work best for kids and families.
Before this recent legislative session began in Connecticut, you wrote an op-ed piece in the CT Mirror, the online news outlet, and you outlined three key issues that you hoped lawmakers would address when it came to improving mental health services for children and teens. They were, first off, support for behavioral health workers. Secondly, expand key services. And third, invest in quality. I'd like to start, if we could, with number one, the health workforce. You said clinicians are compensated at low levels relative to their training, expertise, and importance to the health and well-being of our most vulnerable youth and families. Did lawmakers address this concern, would you say, in this recent legislative session?
I would say that they got off to a very good start. There are several provisions of the three major bills that were in front of the legislature this session, and there were a number of provisions that had to do with supporting the behavioral health workforce. I think there's going to continue to be more work to do out there. Your listeners have probably heard the Great Resignation referred to many times, which affects, I think, broad sectors of the economy. And what we're seeing out there is that behavioral health has certainly not been spared from that crisis. The other point to make here, though, is that this has been a crisis long in the making. There's been a number of years and even decades that we have underinvested in our behavioral health system in general. And we find when we talk with our providers out there in the community, that because of the lack of support or insufficient increases in rates or funding, they've found it difficult to give raises to their employees or to create new positions to address needs. And so we see some things in the legislation this year being passed that help to address some of those concerns. I think there's going to be more work to be done. Just to give you a couple of examples, there were some provisions in House Bill 5001 having to do with workforce. Some of it had to do with ensuring that it was easier for providers from out of state to be able to practice in Connecticut, which I think is helpful for solving a short-term issue. I think in the long term, we need to make sure that we're very robustly supporting our existing community providers who are already in Connecticut. We saw some provisions in the legislature this session that talked about expediting the licensing process. That's been something that we've heard in the community providers, that it can be difficult for people who really do want to work in the behavioral health industry to get their licensure, to sit for the exams, to get the results of the exams, and then to be able to really join the workforce in the community. And so we saw some movement this session to make that process easier and to expedite. And then we saw a number of things that were specific to certain professions or sectors. There were several provisions passed this session that had to do with increasing the number of school-based mental health professionals. We also saw reference to a child psychiatry grant program. Almost every state in the country has got a shortage of child adolescent psychiatrists who can prescribe. And so we saw some movement in the session this year. Higher education had some grant funding allocated towards mental health and psychology internships and things of that nature. So definitely some very good movement this session.
Would you say that the pandemic prompted all of this movement, given the lack of support that you identified going back a number of years?
Yes, I think that's definitely true. I have talked with colleagues over the last several months, and in the years that we've been doing this work at CHDI, there have been really two major moments in time where we've seen significant legislation pass that has improved the children's mental health system. And unfortunately, it's both have been in instances of tragedy. The first was in response to the Sandy Hook shooting and tragedy, and now coming out of the pandemic, we're seeing a renewed interest in children's mental health. So we are happy to see the investments in children's mental health. Those of us who have been doing this work for a long time lament the fact that it takes tragedies of this kind of magnitude to get that kind of attention. But nevertheless, I think we've seen some very good things come out of legislature this session, and we should be happy and excited to see things moving in that direction.
You mentioned about the expansion of key services in your op-ed piece. You touched on a bit of that. Which services needed or need to be expanded?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And, you know, I think one of the insights from the current legislative session is that there were some interesting ideas about new services to be brought online. Things, for example, like a peer-to-peer mentoring program in schools, or development of urgent crisis centers as alternative to the emergency department. Those are great additions to our service continuum. But another thing that I think is really important for us as a state to consider is that we have an existing network of services in the community, and they really are in desperate need of enhancement as well. I think there are three programs when you think about children's mental health and the foundation of the service delivery system. There are really three programs that we think about. The first is just routine outpatient care. And outpatient programs across the state are one of those programs that have for a long time seen the impact of increased prevalence and acuity of mental health needs. And so we really need to think about how do we support that foundational element of any state's service delivery continuum, which is outpatient care. A second area would be our mobile crisis services. And I believe, and we have had involvement with mobile crisis here at CHDI for a number of years, but we consider that to be, and we also hear from our provider executives that they consider it to be another foundational element of our service continuum. Mobile crisis is a great program because it is one of the few programs that if you call 211 and you dial one to access mobile crisis, it's one of the only service delivery programs out there that will deploy a clinician to drive out to your school or drive out to your home or really drive out to anywhere. If we hear stories about meeting families at McDonald's to provide a crisis intervention. And that what that does is it, first of all, makes a connection at a very important time for a child and for a family. It also prevents them from having to use the emergency department or even in some instances to be arrested and enter the juvenile justice system. So that's another really important piece. And I'll just very quickly mention a third element, which is care coordination. We find that a large percentage of children with behavioral health needs are involved in multiple systems like child welfare, juvenile justice, special education. And it can be very difficult for parents and those young people themselves to really manage how much it needs to happen to coordinate their care. And we find that care coordinators can be very, very effective in that area.
And what about investing in quality? That's another thing you mentioned, quality. How did you hope the legislature would address quality? It sounds like a less, a more difficult thing to nail down.
It is. It certainly is. And we do a lot of quality type work here at CHDI. So it is something that's near and dear to us. But what I like to explain to people is a couple of things when it comes to quality. Having access to services is very important. We have to make sure that if you are in need of services, you have access to a provider and you don't have to wait a significant amount of time to access that provider. But then the question becomes, what kind of services do you receive once you're in the door? And we at CHDI are big proponents of evidence-based treatments as one, you know, very straightforward way to increase the quality of behavioral health care. These are interventions that have been tested and developed typically in university settings, where the data shows that it's effective for addressing the issue of concern, whether that be depression or anxiety or conduct problems. And then these evidence-based interventions can be rolled out to the community. So a lot of work that we do at CHDI is to train our network of providers in a number of different evidence-based practices. So that's one concrete way that you can improve the quality of behavioral health care that's being received. And I think a second important area to focus on here is to really think about investing in the ongoing training of the workforce and also the ability of our system to have access to good, strong data so that when something isn't working, we know it quickly and we can make improvements to service delivery. Because I think every child and family who receives behavioral health services deserves to experience really good outcomes. And when things aren't working well, there are strategies that can be put in place to improve the quality of care and get those outcomes that we're all looking for.
Do you think the General Assembly addressed quality well enough this time around, or is there more work to be done there too?
I think you nailed it when you introed this section and said this can be a little bit more difficult for people to define and understand the importance of. So yeah, I would say this is an area that is going to continue to need some development. Now, that being said, there are a number of good quality infrastructure pieces already in the system. So there's lots of lessons learned and ways that we can build on the quality mechanisms that already exist. But that's going to continue to be on our list, and we'll continue to advocate with the legislature to invest in quality.
I'm talking with Jeffrey Vanderplug. He is the president and chief executive officer of the Child Health and Development Institute of Connecticut, CHDI. There are studies that show the pandemic had a disproportionate impact on communities of color and that these communities don't have equitable access or equal access to quality health care. Do the legislature's package of bills, do you think, address that disparity?
Yeah, it's another very good question. I think one way to think about it would be to say, anytime you increase access to behavioral health care and you're making it accessible, you're doing a good thing for all people, including communities of color. I don't think that there was a whole lot in the bills that were passed that specifically drilled down into issues around equity and access for communities of color. I will say that some of the workforce packages that were put into place did place some emphasis on things like teacher minority recruitment. They did have some provisions that asked state agencies, when they put grant programs together, to ensure that they are focusing on diversity, equity, inclusion in the behavioral health workforce with those grant funds. And then I know there was also provisions that had to do with creating funds specifically targeted for families of color to allow them, when they're impoverished, to be able to access services, and that there's funding available in state agencies to be able to provide some financial assistance. So definitely some good elements, but there's so much more that we need to do in this area, because anytime you look at the data, you often will find disparities. And those disparities could be in terms of access to care. The disparities could be in terms of outcomes of care. I will circle back very quickly to my previous comments about evidence-based treatments. We conducted a study here where we looked at treatment outcomes for evidence-based treatments, and we disaggregated those data according to the race, ethnicity of families that were served. And what we found there was very, very interesting. First of all, we found that our evidence-based treatments were, generally speaking, much more effective than usual talk therapy. So that wasn't a great finding in and of itself. But when we drilled down deeper into the disaggregated findings by race, ethnicity, what we discovered there was that our evidence-based treatments were having disproportionately better outcomes and impacts for children and families of color than even for our white families. So that provided some additional justification for us to go to the state agencies and say, not only do we need to invest in just general mental health service access, but we need to specifically target the kinds of services that we know work for children and families of color. So those findings are continuing to come together, and we need to be able to invest as a state in being able to look at our data in such a way that it really tells a story for us and helps us to inform targeted intervention for children and families of color.
Again, we're speaking with Jeffrey Vanderplug of the Child Health and Development Institute of Connecticut. He's the president and chief executive officer. Thank you so much for your time today and your insights about what the legislature has done this time around when it comes to this kind of help for children and teens who are looking for mental health support for things like anxiety and depression. We appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Certainly. You can find links to the legislation we talked about in today's show at our website, WSHU.org. And by the way, you can always email us with ideas or comments at TFS@WSHU.org. We're also on Twitter at FullStoryWSHU. And that's our program for today, produced by Fatou Sangare and senior producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.